It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a program in Milwaukee offers a unique experience featuring conversation among diverse groups of people talking about attitudes, beliefs, and customs. Plus, there's food. We'll visit the Diverse Dining Project.
First, air is essential to life. But when the air isn't clean, it can go beyond an environmental concern and take a real human toll.
According to the World Health Organization, an estimated 4.2 million premature deaths around the world are linked to air pollution each year. But it doesn't have to be that way. Our next guest says we have the power to make change when it comes to the quality of the air we breathe.
Beth Gardner is an environmental journalist who has written for a number of publications, including The New York Times and The Guardian. She's also a former longtime associate press writer. Her new book is Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. She joins us from London. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I'm so glad to be with you.
Well, for a long time, Beth, you saw bad air as an annoyance more than anything else. When did that change for you?
Well, yeah, I live in London, and surprisingly enough, or I found it surprising anyway, the air quality over here is significantly worse than in the States. I had lived in New York before I came to the UK. And, you know, I always noticed this sort of, it's like a thickness you can feel in the air and the smell of exhaust when you walk down the street. And it always kind of bothered me, but no one really seemed to talk about it much. And I happened to be doing a story. It was around the time of the 2012 Olympics that kind of tangentially touched on the issue of air quality. And as part of my research, I sat down and I was, you know, spent not more than a few minutes Googling some of the science of air pollution and what it does to our bodies. And it really didn't take longer than about 5 minutes for my jaw to drop and for me really to become quite shocked, because what I learned and what you would learn if you spend a few minutes online reading some of these studies is that air pollution, you know, kills many thousands of people. It's 40,000 here in the UK every year, 100,000 in the US, many millions around the world. And, you know, I would have been pretty prepared to believe that dirty air could trigger asthma attacks or, you know, cause a variety of breathing problems. But actually what I learned is that the effects go so much further than our lungs. And it was that sort of really wide ranging number of diseases that are connected to air pollution that I think what really took me aback. You know, everything from strokes and heart attacks to dementia and premature birth is really very strongly linked by the science now to air pollution. So I guess that was what shook me out of my complacency about it.
And where is this air pollution coming from? What are the most common or widespread causes?
Well, it kind of varies depending where you look around the world. But generally speaking, there are a few really big contributors, and I think most of them are exactly what you know we might guess. Transportation, so cars, trucks, buses, ships, planes, power generation, so that's electricity plants, particularly coal, is very highly polluting, and industry, factories. I know you have a lot of concerns in Wisconsin about Foxconn, and that's sort of typical of the types of facilities that these concerns sometimes focus on. But then when you look a little bit further afield, you know, in some parts of the world, I guess similar to the way that we used to do in the US and the UK, places like Poland or like China, people are burning coal, not just for power in big power plants, but in their homes for heat. And that's even more polluting because it tends to just be a sort of lower tech operation when you have it in your own house. And, you know, I went to Poland for one of the chapters I did in this book, and it's just, you know, you really can hardly breathe there, particularly in winter when these chimneys are just spewing smoke. But those are the big causes. And, you know, as far as I could tell in all the research that I did, it really pretty much in most places comes down to fossil fuels. And that's what I think links this problem very, you know, very much to climate change.
And I want to come back to the U.S. in just a bit, but you traveled, as you said, to Poland and other places, one of which was South Asia. And you write that South Asia is really air pollution's ground zero. What are the factors there that contribute to such a significant level of air pollution?
Well, it was interesting what I saw, and I reported from Delhi, India. You know, contrary to what I just told you, that in most places it's these sort of few big contributors like transportation or power. In India, what amazed me was just the sheer variety of the number of sources contributing to the air pollution there. So just a few examples, you know, they don't have good garbage collection. So garbage piles up in the streets and then people set fire to it and it burns. And you see these fires, you know, all around Delhi and other Indian and South Asian cities. After the harvest in the fall, farmers set fire to their fields where they have the sort of stalks and things left over after they harvest the rice and wheat. And that produces these huge clouds of smoke. And literally, they're so thick that NASA can photograph these plumes of smoke from space. And they drift to Delhi. And every sort of November or so, you know, the levels of these tiny particulates, which are very damaging to our health, just go absolutely through the roof in Delhi. A lot of the contributors over there are really sort of come down to failures of infrastructure and failures of governance, really, and of enforcement. There are a lot of laws on the books that don't get enforced. You know, the garbage example, obviously, if they had better garbage collection, then there wouldn't be a need for people to burn, you know, trash in the streets. If there was better supply of natural gas, then people wouldn't have to burn wood and cow dung in their homes to cook. So there were a lot of different sources, but to me, it sort of all came down to infrastructure and governance deficits.
We're talking with Beth Gardiner. Her new book is Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. And coming back to the United States, you looked at California and specifically the Children's Health Study.
Yes.
What did the results show about the impact of air pollution?
Yeah, so that's one of the really big and important studies that has been done in this field over many years, actually over decades, by a group of scientists at the University of Southern California. And they followed thousands of kids for many years. And what they found was that the children who lived in places with more polluted air actually had less developed lungs by the time they reached 18 or 20 years old, and that's when your lungs stop growing. Their lungs were actually physically less powerful, and that is a very strong predictor of health problems later in life. So lung capacity is a really important sort of part of good health. And, you know, that's something I see quoted all the time in the newspapers, even here in London. Our kids' lungs are stunted. Our kids' lungs are smaller because they're breathing this dirty air on the city streets here. You know, so I think that is something that was really powerful and was very surprising at the time, because back in the 90s when this study began, it was pretty well understood in the scientific community that air pollution could have an immediate impact on you, you know, whether it was an asthma attack or even a heart attack on a day when pollution spiked. But it was unclear whether there would be long-term impacts too. So, you know, when the air clears, are you then fine? Or if you breathe dirty air over many years, is that going to give you a higher risk of, you know, problems later in life? And unfortunately, that is what turned out to be true.
And as you look at things like the California Children's Health Study, or when you're visiting Poland or South Asia, or where you live in London, are there certain people who are more affected by the levels of air pollution than others? Are there demographic differences?
Yeah. So, you know, anyone who's sort of more vulnerable, anyone with a kind of pre-existing health condition will probably be more affected, and more widely children and older people are more likely to be affected by the effects of air pollution. But, you know, I think when you talk about all these different health effects and some of the numbers we were bouncing around earlier of how many people die every year from this, I think that what is difficult for us to apprehend, and really is part of why I got started on this reporting project, is that even though all of these things we've been talking about and these links to ill health are very rigorously grounded in science, there's sort of an invisibility around air pollution. And not only in the sense that we, you know, sometimes can't actually see the pollution in the air, but to us as sort of lay people, you know, non-scientists, there's an invisibility in the sense that we can't make out the connection between cause and effect. You know, people die and get sick. You know, if you lose someone you love, or if someone gets sick, or if I have a heart attack tomorrow, you know, you would never know, or I would never be able to say, no doctor could tell me that it's because I lived in London and I breathed dirty air for a long time. You know, it's hard to ever nail down in an individual case. So in a sense, even though this is something that is really having a very powerful impact on our health and our lives, we're not aware of it. You know, you'll never know. And I think that that also creates a sort of, you know, it has historically created a political challenge around the sorts of laws and regulations that are required to bring cleaner air, because we know for sure that when pollution goes down, you know, people get healthier and you literally have less cancer or less dementia, fewer deaths. But people never sort of apprehend the benefits. So in terms of politics, you don't kind of get that payoff that, you know, you need.
We're talking with Beth Gardiner. Her new book is Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever lived in a place where the air quality was a big concern? Were you worried about the health impacts? Do you experience that right now where you're living today? Have you seen your community, your government make efforts to improve air quality where you live? And what kind of things would you like to see happen? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Beth Gardiner. She's the author of the book Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What worries you or gives you hope when it comes to air quality in Wisconsin, in the United States, around the world? Do you live or have you lived in a place known for poor air quality? Have you seen this impact the health of the people where you live? If you're in healthcare yourself, have you seen these kind of impacts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org.
And let's go to the phones. And Nick in Green Bay is up. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Nick. Hey, Judith. It's nice to hear you on the radio. I live in Green Bay. And it's just horrible. I'm kind of concerned about my son, but they are trying to clean up the Fox River, but it's such an amazing difference to go from Green Bay to Gwin, where my wife is from, Michigan, because the air is so much cleaner.
Thanks for that call, Nick. And have you seen any efforts in Green Bay to try to make the air quality better?
Not the air quality, but they are cleaning up the Fox River, and they're trying to make it swimmable again, so I guess that's a big plus, but I'm more concerned about my kids. What are we, like, passing on to our kids?
Thanks for that call, Nick. And Beth, you know, going back to that children's health study, Nick probably has reason to be concerned.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, it's very powerful and very worrying when you start to think about, you know, this sort of invisible, you know, menace that we're breathing. Is impacting us and is impacting our children. And, you know, talking about that children's health study, one thing that they learned from that, because it's a study that's moved forward sort of and come up with a lot of new findings over the decades that it's been going, has been, you know, not just that air pollution is linked to long-term health problems for particularly for children, but for all of us, but also that it has a detrimental effect even at much lower levels than were previously realized. So, you know, it's important to know that across America, our air quality has improved really dramatically over the last 50 years. And that's mainly because of the success of the Clean Air Act of 1970. And the EPA's, you know, success in enforcing it. Our air is a lot cleaner than it was, but studies like the Children's Health Study have helped us to understand that even levels of pollution that, you know, 30 years ago we would have thought that sounds great are actually, you know, still killing people. But I guess the sort of flip side of that is that the lower that you can get levels of air pollution, the cleaner you can make your air, you're saving people's lives as you do that. So, you know, there's a sort of positive spin on it as well, I guess.
I want to go more into the history of the Clean Air Act, but first let's go to Jeff in Superior on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's a beautiful day here on the shores of Lake Superior. So I'm concerned about the air quality inland in Wisconsin because of the agricultural areas. For example, I lived in Chicago for 11 years, and the air was fresh right off Lake Michigan because I happen to live just a couple blocks off Lake Shore Drive. But here in Duluth Superior, we get the wind off the lake, and the air is constantly fresh. But when I go inland, like around some farming areas, I'm smelling manure and that uric acid and the pesticides they're spraying on the plants. I don't always think that that's the freshest air, and yet the irony is everybody thinks, oh, the air is so fresh in the countryside. Well, I experience the freshest air on the shores of a great lake.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. And Beth, it is interesting what Jeff is saying, because I think often when we think of air pollution, we think of things being burned or things coming out of a smokestack. But is there a whole other level of pollutants out there?
Yeah, there is, actually. I was surprised to learn this myself in my research, and I agree with you that I think intuitively a lot of people think, oh, this is an urban problem. But agriculture is actually a very significant contributor to air quality problems. I think it's something like half of the particulate matter, these very small and dangerous particles in American air, come from agriculture. And some of the pollution that's in the air is sort of directly emitted. It comes out of a tailpipe or a smokestack and you breathe it and it's bad for you. But there are also a lot of sort of chemical reactions that are occurring in the air. So what happens with agriculture, as your caller said, is that there's different gases coming off of, it's a combination of fertilizers and sometimes feed that ferments. And there's also methane that comes from manure. And, you know, with industrial scale agriculture today, you see these huge manure lagoons that are sort of, they bubble them to get some of the gases off. And those things combine in the air and they can create pollutants that are damaging to our health. So I went to the San Joaquin Valley in California, and I have a chapter from there, which is really focused on the air pollution that comes from agriculture and particular from dairy. But that would certainly all be very applicable to Wisconsin as well, because it's exactly the same, dynamic with the cows and the fertilizer and all of that. So the caller's absolutely right. Agriculture is a big polluter.
We're talking with Beth Gardiner. She's the author of Choked: Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. And Beth, you mentioned that we are just about at the 50-year anniversary of the Clean Air Act. And, you know, that reading your book, that came at a time when talking about environmental regulation and environmental concerns was a fairly new idea.
Yeah, actually, people didn't even really use the word environment back then. This was in the late 1960s, and the Clean Air Act was passed at the end of 1970. But there was starting to be a growing awareness. And, you know, back then you could actually really very literally see the smog hanging over, you know, cities all over the country. And there was a recognition that this was a problem that sort of needed to be dealt with. In researching this, I really came to feel that the Clean Air Act of 1970 is unquestionably one of the most consequential and important laws in modern American history. Literally, according to the studies that have been done by the EPA of its effect, it has literally saved millions of American lives and trillions of dollars since 1970 when it was passed. And, you know, what really I thought was particularly amazing, because when we discuss sort of environmental regulation and imposing restrictions on industry and on polluters, you know, there always tends to be a lot of concern about the price tag, understandably. What is this going to cost? But actually, when the analysis has been done, the benefits of the Clean Air Act have literally been dozens of times greater than the costs, the benefits in monetary terms of all the improved health and the productivity and the, you know, healthcare savings and all of that have literally been 30 and 40 times the cost. So, you know, I guess that's important to sort of be aware of going forward as other regulations get considered. And the other remarkable thing is that this was a bipartisan piece of legislation. It literally passed the Senate unanimously. It got one no vote in the House of Representatives. You know, I doubt that you or I could think of the most innocuous piece of legislation that would be unanimously approved in the Senate today, let alone a law that gave far-reaching new powers to the federal government.
And I also found it really interesting, Beth, in reading your book, that the authors of the Clean Air Act realized that they might not know what pollutants were coming in the future.
Yeah, it was actually a very, very well-designed piece of legislation, and I think that's part of why it's been so effective. And it was quite innovative. It had some provisions in it that hadn't been used before. But one thing that they, you know, were very aware of was that the science was advancing, as you say, and they sort of built this future-proofing into it. So the way that the Clean Air Act works is that it requires the EPA every 5 years to assess the sort of state of the science and set levels of acceptable levels of air pollution according to, you know, what the latest science says. And you can add new pollutants if they are discovered that harm human health. And indeed, that is really, you know, in the headlines literally today, because one of the pollutants that the Clean Air Act has been used to regulate is carbon dioxide, which doesn't harm our health if we breathe it in, but that is one of the most important greenhouse gases that's leading to climate change. There was a Supreme Court decision back in, I think, 2007, which said that the EPA would have to regulate carbon dioxide under the Clean Air Act. But it's very much in question now, actually, because that was at issue in the new regulation announced yesterday.
And we'll have to leave it there. Beth, thank you so much for joining us. Beth Gardner is an environmental journalist who has written a number of publications, including The New York Times and The Guardian. Her new book is titled Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. She joined us from London.
Stick around. There's more to come. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Picture yourself at a dinner table with people you haven't met before. You're trying new foods, and the conversation is focused on the attitudes, beliefs, and customs of people from different backgrounds.
That's the experience you have at a diverse dining event in Milwaukee. It's a project that started just about a year ago that aims to build connections and compassion.
Emerald Mills is an experienced facilitator who has spent 16 years working for nonprofits and other organizations that focus on community and health education. She's the founder of Diverse Dining, and she joins us from our studio in Milwaukee. Emerald, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Hello, everybody.
What inspired you to start this diverse dining experience?
Well, so many things served as inspiration for me starting the business. I think what finally pushed me or drove me to do it was just the current climate that we live in, and more particularly some of the statistics, the negative statistics that we often hear about the city of Milwaukee and it being a very segregated or most segregated city, and just wanting to change the narrative and help people build more authentic relationships, including myself.
I understand that you grew up in a place where you didn't feel like things were that divided, where people who came from different backgrounds, they ran into each other, they talked to each other, and Milwaukee was kind of a shock to you.
Correct. It was. I grew up in Zion, Illinois, so it was a much smaller town and smaller community. To my knowledge, it just was normal to speak and greet and show compassion and caring and concern when your neighbor or anybody in that environment had an issue. And it just seemed to feel a little different when I moved here. I could definitely tell that there were restrictions or not so much specific, but there were definitely barriers that seemed to be put up to say, you should be with this group of people, you should be with this group of people, and I didn't particularly like it. So,
and dining is half the story here. Why is it important that food is part of the story when you bring people together?
Well, as I was thinking about what I would do and how I would do it, I realized one of the places where you don't see or you see the least amount of segregation typically is around food or at restaurants. People tend to venture out just by their own curiosity and just by way of, I think, enjoying good food. So it just seemed to be a place that if you did see people crossing paths or crossing communities, it typically was in a restaurant setting. In addition to that, I just love food and good food, and I think that I have also studied Maslow's hierarchy of needs for a series of years and majoring in communication in college, and understand that when people's basic needs are met, they're a little bit more open and less defensive to receive more information. So,
talking to Emerald Mills, founder of Diverse Dining in Milwaukee. Emerald, talk us through it. If we show up, if we schedule one of these events and show up, what do we experience as a participant?
So first of all, you can book me with your company, and I can do one there. Or if you come to an event in the community, the way the event would look would be you first would have a requirement to not sit by someone you know. So we would require that you sit with a stranger. We make it a little bit easier because we create custom icebreakers that are focused on a specific topic. So through that icebreaker, you get to learn about things that you typically wouldn't learn about an individual by a way that you're not coming up with your own question or feeling like you're asking a question that may be appropriate, but having a guided way to interact and have certain conversations. And then once you move from that, we typically do an introduction of the evening, who I am with Diverse Dining, who our facilitator may be that day, as well as we give you a little bit more of an in-depth understanding of the restaurant that we may be hosting in or the space that we're hosting in, things that you typically wouldn't know if you just walked in the door and sat down and had dinner. After that, we typically play maybe a brief game before we have a dialogue from whoever the guest speaker is of that night about whatever subject we're focusing on. So we've had conversations about things like vulnerability, as well as things more specific to culture, like understanding misconceptions of the Asian culture. So depending on the topic, we would have a facilitator who has a personal story about that subject talk us through that. Then we close with a call to action and discussion questions that we all talk about together from our own experiences before we wrap up the night.
Emerald, is there fear sometimes of people coming in and sitting and eating and talking with people from different backgrounds, fear that either, hey, I'm going to say something that really offends somebody, or one of these other people here is going to say something horrible that's going to offend me?
Well, I think that we do a great job of helping people with that. I think naturally, without having a guided process, there's definitely fear. People typically come in not knowing what they're going to get, but we do set ground rules before we start and help people to understand that if people are walking in and paying for tickets to come to something like this, then they probably have at least a curiosity and at least a sense of wanting to know and wanting to understand. So we serve up a lot of compassion and understanding at our dinners to make sure that people are not judging other people and really trying to hear what people's questions are so that they can be answered.
What kind of things do you hear from people after they've done Diverse Dining experiences?
Oh, God. Well, first of all, I have some close friends that have come to one and now have been at all of them. One of my actual team members now started out at our first event at the Tandem a year ago. We get together and talk on the phone at least once a week. I've been to her barbecues, which we have diversified quite a bit. We build great relationships. So people who have come here from other states say that they feel welcome and at home. One quote from a guy who came said that we make uncomfortable conversations tasty and tasteful, and I steal that quote quite a bit myself.
Now, your next event is a little unique, it sounds like, on June 25th, coming up pretty soon. What's the focus of your next event?
So, again, we do focus on more than just race and diversity and race. Our next event is Turning the Tables, and it's a kid-focused event. So we'll have kids speaking about diversity from their perspective or just their own experiences, and adults will get to listen to how they see life and how they experience life from their lens. And that event is June 25th at 6 p.m. at 88.9 radio station.
Do you have lessons that people might take home in their daily lives that you've learned along the way that might help people build a bridge with somebody that they wouldn't have talked to otherwise?
Well, I think the lesson is, you know, though we are all different, I mean, I think one is every person is different, even if you look alike. But then every person probably has a common thread that makes them the same. And so though we definitely all have differences, whether you're all white or all black or all young or all old, we also have a common thread as human beings that make us connected. And so if we can get past the things that separate us and sometimes give people a certain level of compassion and grace to understand where they're coming from before we defend or get angry or upset, or just being able to know you're wrong and learn from that experience, then we all can grow and live in an environment that's better for everybody.
Like you said earlier, this isn't really what we see in the news a lot. We see the differences and the divisions. Do you think with a little work we can overcome at least a lot of that?
Well, I definitely think that we would have to duplicate this effort in a massive amount, and hopefully I'll have some influence in doing that. But I definitely know that the relationships that have been formed through the dinner conversations have helped change and shape me as an individual, as well as others who come around the table. So I definitely think that the work can be done. It just will need to be done by more people.
You mentioned that you've grown and changed just in this year you've been doing it. What kind of things have you learned about yourself in this year of diverse dining?
Well, I learned that, that's a good question. I've learned that, I think what I kind of mirrored earlier, that, you know, that we all are different, and being different is okay. That just because you disagree with someone doesn't mean you block them on Facebook or you don't have to be in a room with them. I think that I've learned how to navigate a little bit better those conflicts that come up. I also believe that, you know, conflict is just a part of life. If there's no conflict, then you remove growth, you remove the ability to change your perspective. So I've learned that I'm okay with that, and I also learned I'm a little more daring than I think to start some kind of initiative like this on my own. So,
Emerald, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Yep, thanks for having me. Have a good one.
You too. That's Emerald Mills, founder of Diverse Dining. She joined us from our studio in Milwaukee. The next dinner is on June 25th. There's details available on their website. We've got a link posted on the Central Time page over at WPR.org.
Two Republican senators have come out in opposition to the state budget plan recently passed by the Joint Finance Committee.
Senators Steve Noss of Whitewater and David Craig of Big Bend say they'll vote no when the budget gets taken up next week. That means if any more Republicans oppose the bill, it would need Democratic votes to pass the Senate and move on to the Assembly.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sean, first off, why are Senators Noss and Craig saying that they'll be voting no on the budget as it currently stands?
They have listed quite a few things and, you know, kind of said that they agree with each other on this. So one of the things that I think the biggest thing that Senator Dave Craig mentioned today was that the budget spends too much. It's roughly $81.7 billion budget over 2 years. That's all funds, so state taxpayer money and federal money, every source of revenue. And that is less than the budget that Governor Evers proposed, but it does represent about a 5.5% increase over the last budget, the way that the legislature's budget office calculates that. So that's kind of where Dave Craig starts, and then they kind of go through a list of other items. There are fee increases in this budget for, you know, people who buy vehicles. There's a sizable vehicle title increase, an annual vehicle registration fee increase. There is a study in here that could lead to some type of tolling or, you know, a vehicle miles traveled registration fee in the future. Senators Craig and Noss don't like that. They don't like the stewardship fund, the borrowing. So their list kind of goes on and on. Right now, they're the only two Republican senators who have come out and said affirmatively that they are definitely voting no. But there are others who are kind of on the bubble.
And who are those others and how many are there?
I guess we know right now of Senator Chris Kapinga is the name that everybody's kind of watching. Chris Kapinga was somebody who held out in the last budget, along with Craig and Nass. One name that we had been watching, but who said today that he would, in fact, vote for the budget was Senator Dewey Strobel. He was part of that same group in the last budget that held out for changes. But Senator Strobel, who was on the legislature's budget committee this time around, said today that he would support the budget, and he thinks it's kind of a good counterpoint, a conservative counterpoint to Governor Evers.
Now that Republicans in the Senate can't afford to lose any more votes, there will be a lot of attention on Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. Sean, what is his specific task right now?
I guess his task, the way that they're going to view this budget, is to get 17 Republican votes. And so if Senators Nass and Craig are out there saying they definitely won't support it, and Craig was pretty adamant that unless there was a sizable spending decrease, he's a no. Senator Nass had a really long list of stuff and said that he's a no. So if they're definitely not going to vote for this, it gives people like Senator Kapinga or whoever else is in the Senate who's kind of on the bubble about this budget, gives them more leverage to demand changes. And so Fitzgerald has to answer all those changes without losing, you know, somebody else in his caucus if he wants to get 17 votes to pass this thing with only Republicans. So they could, in theory, go to Democrats and say, hey, I've got some problems with my conservative members. Let's get a bipartisan budget here. But then they're going to have, you know, to make much bigger changes and get the budget closer to the one that Governor Evers introduced. And they don't want to do that.
We're talking with WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson right now with the news that two Republican senators have said that they will not vote for the budget bill in its current state. Now, Sean, Governor Evers gave a press conference this morning reiterating his support for things like Medicaid expansion and more education funding in the budget. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
Let's see if the legislators can listen and will listen to the people. Legislators have the opportunity to amend this budget to do what the people of Wisconsin have asked us to do. I firmly believe that if they ignore the will of the people, they do it at their own peril.
Sean, the Joint Finance Committee reduced or cut a lot of proposals that Governor Evers had in the budget. Senators Nass and Craig say the plan still spends too much, even with those reductions. If this doesn't pass the Senate, where might Republicans look to address that concern while still coming up with something the governor will sign?
It's hard to imagine it not passing the Senate. It's just a matter of what it's going to look like when it does. I think Republicans are going to want, they have an incentive to try to pass this amongst themselves. We just don't know what it's going to look like once they do that and they send it to the governor's desk. There's just kind of a tricky situation. If they make too many changes, they could lose other people. I think what struck out today listening to Governor Evers talk was that he started out his press conference by saying, you can still do my top priorities. It's the will of the people to have Medicaid expansion in Wisconsin. It's something that's a point that he continues to come back to over and over again. And so that was one of the points that he made. But he also said, look at how much better this budget is than it would have been if I weren't governor. You know, he's saying, look how far I took the Republicans my way. And so while he's not out there saying what he's going to do with the final budget, he's saying, I'm not going to comment on whether there's going to be a veto until it passes the legislature. He's saying a couple things. You can make changes, but look at how good this budget is, and that's due to me.
Are there any items that Governor Evers has telegraphed that have to be in the budget for him to sign it?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Medicaid expansion is the thing that he has talked about the most, especially as this budget debate has kind of come to the closing days or weeks. That is the issue that he will talk about at every stop, and Republicans have showed no signs that they're going to budge on that issue, but Evers is very happy to talk about it. He cites the poll results for Medicaid expansion in Marquette's survey, which showed 70% of the public supports it. So it's an issue that he's happy to talk about. Whether or not he wins on it, in this budget, but he hasn't gone out there and said, I will veto a budget if it does not expand Medicaid, or I will veto a budget if it does not spend what I wanted to spend on school funding, you know, because he wanted to spend an additional $900 million, and that's not in here. So he has not drawn that line in the sand and has not said, he's not hinting very strongly at this point, I don't think, that he would veto the whole thing.
Sean, you alluded to this earlier, just a couple of years ago in 2017, passage of the budget was held up for several months due to Republican disagreement, in that case mostly over transportation, and some of the same names, Steve Nass and also Senator Craig. How did that ultimately get resolved a couple of years ago?
A couple of years ago, they had a different governor, and so they were able to cut a deal with Governor Scott Walker to have him promise to veto some stuff if they passed the budget out of the Senate. And so Governor Walker ended up vetoing some of the things that were top priorities of Assembly Republicans. It was not a very popular move with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss at the time. He had some choice words for the Republican senators who cut that deal. At the time, he alluded to them as terrorists. But he's not doing that this time around. And it's going to be harder for them to cut any kind of a deal with the governor's office this time around, because their views on how this budget should change are basically polar opposite to the changes that Governor Tony Evers wants to see.
And if the Senate does make some changes that allows passage of the budget bill by Republicans in the Senate, it then goes to the Assembly for a vote. How might an altered budget fare in that House?
I think what they might do, and this is it's still in the realm of speculation, but they might basically decide what the final deal needs to look like. And then the Assembly will vote on it first. And then that Assembly budget will go to the Senate. And the understanding would be that there'd be no changes on it in the Senate. That's not a done deal, but that's one way that this could proceed, is they just kind of agree on it first, pass those agreements, there were Republican agreements in the Assembly, and then the Senate's basically a foregone conclusion.
And is the Assembly a pretty secure block of voting to pass whatever comes down?
They can just afford to lose more Republican votes over there and still pass this. They have 63 Republicans in that chamber, so Assembly Speaker Robin Voss can afford to lose some of his conservative members who think it spends too much, or maybe some of his moderate members, or people who live in more competitive districts who maybe think it spends too little. He just has more wiggle room over there in terms of votes that he can lose and still pass it.
And Sean, briefly before we let you go, this is basically the operating budget for the state, but there's also a capital budget that deals with state building projects. How is that bill progressing?
It's all wrapped up in the same bill. So the $1.9 billion in new borrowing that the Finance Committee agreed to for building projects in the state, it's all part of this debate. And that's one of the things that Senators Craig and Nass have cited as reasons they want to vote against it. Republicans on the Finance Committee were actually pretty close to Governor Evers when it comes to the capital budget. Nass and Craig don't like that.
And Sean, what should we be watching for? What's the likely next step in this process?
I think you're just watching to see if another Republican senator joins Nass and Craig, because then you're talking about needing, more significant changes to the budget. If they kind of band together and stop it, they could, force larger changes to the budget. And instead of having something passed next week, it could be a little while.
Well, Sean, thanks as always for bringing us up to speed.
Thanks, Judith.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He gave us an update on where the state budget bill stands after two Republican senators have already said that they'll be voting against it.
You can follow the latest on the budget process online at WPR.org. And you can also let us know what you think about the budget as it develops. What parts of it are important to you? Where are you in favor of more investment? Where do you think there's room to cut spending? What do you think of the argument of increasing the gas tax versus registration fees for cars? Which is the better approach, do you think, for how we pay for our roads? Should we take federal money to expand Medicaid programs, Badger Care here in Wisconsin? Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. The best cure for garlic breath is to be with other people who also have garlic breath, so nobody notices. And you'll have an opportunity to do just that at Garlic Fest this Sunday in Milwaukee.
Garlic Fest includes lots of foods made for the occasion with garlic in the name of every dish, I'm assuming also in every dish. And if that's not enough garlic for you, you can join in on the raw garlic eating contest.
Well, I do like a bit of garlic. I think the raw garlic eating contest would be a little much for me.
So we put raw, sometimes raw shallots, but often raw garlic in our salads. Like with a vinaigrette.
I was going to say something.
Not like... Like
you
what?
Can kind of smell you coming around. No, no, I do like a little raw garlic, but then it also it depends on the garlic. Like there's really garlicky garlic or there's kind of mellow garlic.
Yes.
And I don't never know which is which.
Yeah. At the farmer's market, actually, there are some vendors that have like 8 or 10 different garlics. And yeah, I will have, I'll buy one. I'll try. I'll think, oh, I love this one. And then I can never remember which one it is.
Now, I got to be careful. There's a thing on my mom's side of the family where some of her and her siblings, like if they have a morsel of garlic, you can smell them. Hundreds of feet away. And I think I have a little bit of that. So, yeah, I have to be in the company of garlic eaters to eat garlic.
Well, sounds like Sunday in Milwaukee.
Garlic Fest.
There you go.
Maybe I'll have my own garlic fest at home. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.